Another week, another podcast, another enjoyable time together.
These fly by. Today we covered a lot of ground. We kicked off with talking about how long until your next round. So looking at some of the data of periods between raises and how that's changing and getting longer.
We then expanded that into some cool AI back tools that we've been using and how to use those to get some scale. And what we're seeing is that whilst it's taking longer, deals are getting done. And we talked about valuations are starting to creep up a bit.
Yeah, and then we touched on the work of Telstra Ventures, particularly out of the US. And we talked about concentric Venn diagram circles of right versus happy versus rich and how they might not overlap for all cases and scenarios. And that led us into a conversation around Tesla.
Yeah, a bit of Tesla, a bit of Elon in terms of what's happening there and a few lessons that then led us to Twiggy Forest. Can you believe it? Now, whilst Fortescue and Twiggy is not the general topic, there are some lessons here for entrepreneurs in terms of what happens with high staff turnover, what happens with disintegration internally, and what we think entrepreneurs, especially in high growth tech companies, can learn from that. Because ultimately, people follow people, people join for people, and people leave people. So let's get into it. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, guys.
Jack's back in a jumper.
Yeah. That's Adelaide weather.
So it's turned cold on you, has it, buddy?
Yeah, it was fresh this morning, but it's been really nice throughout the day. So I can't complain with this weather.
I'm really looking forward to South Start. I hope everyone listening is going to head down there, not just because we've got gigs, but it's a great event in a great region and we'll be able to hang.
Yeah, come to South Start. You don't have to listen to the bits that we do, but just...
I highly recommend that you don't.
I can't wait. It's always a great event. And it's just that it's that one event that almost everyone travels to be there. So everyone's got that time free to catch up and connect.
Yeah. Not really looking forward to that. And Jack, you've been on the road this week, meeting, greeting. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going really good. I met with a fair few people in the ecosystem over the past 2 weeks. Really nice people. It's good to get involved and starting meeting people down here. So it's been a good week.
It's a cracker of an ecosystem down there.
Yeah, yeah. Shout out to anybody in Adelaide. Jack has a swag. We'll travel.
By swag, he means merch.
Merch. Yeah, other people's merch.
Sleeps in hoodies.
Yeah.
And you, Aaron?
Busy week, just hitting the phones and sorting mission stuff. That's about as exciting as my life gets. But I'm already counting down the days until London. I can't wait to be back in the UK.
You look like, with that shirt, not to be rude, are you about to start like a 9-to-5 job at the tax office or something?
It's just a white collared shirt. Am I that boring?
Well, considering that I'm wearing the one that... Do you work at Tribe?
Tribe!
The big yell.
For those not watching the video, Don's just got plastered from left armpit to right armpit. Tribe!
Yeah. My wife, every time I put these on, she's, oh, where do you work? What do you do again? Love you, darling. All right. We've got a whole random range of things today. Let's jump in. There was some data released by Peter Walker showing that the time between rounds, so price seed to series A to B to C, that time generally keeps getting longer. What this chart is showing is that it's looking at the 25th percentile, the median, and then the 75th percentile, so those that are quickest through to those that are slowest. And as an example, from your price seed round to series A, now keeping in mind that this is US data, but from a timing perspective, I think we're seeing the same thing happen here, just with our own experience. During the heady days, as an example, the median between seed and series A was 566, but that's now crept up to 676. And at the slowest end, at the 75th percentile, the median of that percentile, we've gone from 887 days through to 1,141 days. So we're moving from like the 1 year to the 2 year to the 3 years. And there's a similar transition from A to B and B to C, but where we concentrate is more that seed to series A.
Yeah, it's interesting the pattern correlation across all stages. So seed to series A to B to C, pretty similar pattern and even almost similar data. There's only kind of one that doesn't correlate clearly. What was interesting for me, that the text of the post, The implication is it's taking longer to close rounds, which I do believe. It's not clear on causality here. I think a lot of companies have gone back to fundamentals, improved their cash positions and avoiding going back to market. So I know this is tracking from close to close and the implication is it's taking longer to close, but actually I think also companies are stretching their dollars and delaying starting rounds as well. So it is a little bit hard to know exactly what the data is telling us, but intuitively, yes, longer to close rounds.
Yeah, on a healthy basis, if you're able to grow more organically before you need the money, excellent.
Yeah, great.
But at the same time, if you're not and you do need the money and you're planning a seed round that you're not going to get profitable, what this is suggesting is that you probably need to raise a longer runway than you may have in other times.
Yeah, it's definitely confirming that the speed of capital deployment is slowing. So yeah, whatever the causality, that's the reality. So it is the era of resourcefulness as opposed to being flush of resources.
Yeah. And so there's a couple of reminders, I think, for people. Reminder number one, in an environment that is a little harder to come by or slower, or investors don't have same drive to get deals done, we're seeing investors just sitting on the sideline a lot more. A couple of reminders. Reminder number one, how you pitch becomes really important. It's always important. That's not the right word. But yeah, a few reminders of, yeah, the purpose of your first pitch is not to get money. Even the second pitch, quite often. Purpose of the pitch for money is not to get money. It's to get interest. It's to get engagement. It's to create a relationship. It's to get somebody saying, oh, that's interesting, I want to find out more. And if you take that approach, what that means is instead of turning up like a fire hose and trying to explain everything and verbally vomit everywhere, the way you go about it is to actually, the way I like to think about it is going a mile wide and an inch deep. First explain the whole picture at a very high level. That should only take a couple of minutes. And then pull on a few, let the person you're talking to go down the paths that they're interested in. Oh, that's interesting you said this. Can we unpack that a little bit more? Or how do you achieve that? Or what do you mean by that? It allows you to be conversational.
And just to add to that, Dom, even though the first pitch may just be to get interest, it's still every touch point with an investor is basically an interview. So you have to be polished from end to end. And like Absolutely. Any opportunity you get to speak, like you've got to make sure you're prepared and you know exactly how it's going to go.
Yeah.
I think being very conscious of what you leave out of the deck. I've had three chats with founders this week, helping them on their pitch decks. And there's a correlation, like highly technical, intelligent founders that are in love with their product tend to put so much information on the product side, the tech, and they leave out any sort of commercial detail. And that point of the point of the deck is to get engagement for the follow-up conversation. And so
to show that you know what your plan is to build customers, what your go-to-market strategy is, how you're going to create leads, how do you convert them.
Exactly.
It's never the best product that wins anyway. It's the best marketed and sold products, and that's why investors are going to be looking at.
I think it'd be worthwhile in a future episode, we do a deep dive on what we like to see in deck. Because Aaron, we've seen a few this week. If it's a cold inbound and it's 40 slides and it's just going in far too heavy, I really don't like that. Give me a 10 slide deck that I can gain some interest and then we can go deeper after the initial call.
Yeah, 100%. It would be good to do a deck review. Maybe, so throwing this out there, what if we invited a founder to actually do a session that they're happy for us to record and share?
We are kind. We will allow you to edit anything out that you don't like.
We are kind in intent.
Yeah, in intent. No, it's good. I recommend always practicing, always get some feedback. And if anybody's willing to do it so other people can learn, I think that would be great. And it takes practice and it's not easy.
Yeah.
I remember a couple of years ago, it had been, I don't know, 5 or 6 years since I'd left my little world of needing to raise capital and hadn't pitched for capital. And one of the companies I was on the board of couldn't make a pitch up north. And I said, don't worry about it. I'll do it. She'll be sweet. I know this. Holy moly. I got ripped apart. I was an embarrassment because it's just important that you practice, that you have the ability to dance, have the ability to explain. And what it taught me was that as someone that's an investor and on the board and passionate about this business, actually there was a whole lot of detail I was not across on. And I remember this one guy, I can still picture him. He must have been bullied at school or difficult relationship with his parents or whatever. But once he realized he had someone weak on the stage, he went after me like you've not seen. And the joy that I brought him through the pain of him clearly being able to extract what a moron I was. So anyway, each to their own.
But how valuable are those experiences? I remember my two co-founders and I went to Silicon Valley and we were actually pitching something. It wasn't even for investment. It was an ecosystem program. But this guy absolutely ripped us to shreds. And we didn't talk. It was probably 4 hours afterwards. We did not say a single word to each other. We were just so destroyed. But the insights we gained from that, that completely transformed what we did going forward.
Yeah. No, I'd recommend the more practice, the better you are going to get. And the reality is, especially in this market, probably takes 50 to 100 meetings or discussions. And so get used to, I think I mentioned this on the last episode maybe, or one of them. There's a couple of videos going around, whether it's Michael Keaton or the Breaking Bad guy or even DiCaprio. They talk about, Pitt says the same thing. Once they realize that the audition was the gig, the audition was the job, not to have expectation and just do the best they could and be grateful that they got an audition, their mindset changed, how they approached it changed, their authenticity changed, and then the results changed. Whereas when we go into it with high expectations and desperation and your psychology changes, how you go about it changes. And for them, they were just explaining, no, the audition is the job, do it my best. And then when I leave that audition, that's it. They found their careers really jumped.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then the second lesson is, if it's going to take longer to raise for whatever reason, that organic growth demonstration is just so important. And 2020, 2021, early 22, here's an idea and trust me, was able to get a lot of capital. Now it's, here's my idea. Here was my plan. I've executed on that plan. I've got traction. I've got organic growth. And now I need capital to grow it. That's what's getting capital. And we're seeing a lot of founders just spending so much time trying to raise capital to validate the idea. Whereas if they put that time and effort into getting some customers, to getting an MVP, to reduce the scale of their grandeur at this early stage, we're seeing that those ones win out.
Yeah. And it's not just funding for the idea that's struggling, but funding for product development. Like I've seen a couple of these recently raising a lot of capital to go into product development, a tiny allocation for customer or market development, and that they're struggling to get funding. So and the other thing to be really conscious of at the moment, like we've seen this with something we were looking at this week, is those that are raising capital, be really conscious of capital efficiency, like how you are using that capital and the demonstrated revenue growth and traction that you get on the other side of it, because otherwise your next round will be with that much harder.
Yeah. And it's a bit of a sign, it's a bit of a tell at the moment that if you build an MVP that customers don't run away with and love and at least engage, even though it may not be perfect, it's a sign of the future that maybe the problem isn't as big as you think, or maybe they're not willing to move as quickly, or there's internal frictions inside companies that stop them from adopting it fast. And if you can't demonstrate strong demand and an appetite to adopt something swiftly in the organic stages, money ain't going to solve that.
Yeah, and confirmation of the problem isn't enough. Like we've seen this with a deal we were reviewing this week, where great feedback from the market segment on the problem. No shortage of validation that this is a huge problem. Everyone recognizes the problem, and yet it's not converting into actual sales and revenue growth at the speed you would expect given the scale of that problem. So you really have to look at the metrics that matter, like that conversion piece, and be experimenting and discovering, why aren't you converting if it is such a big compelling problem? What other frictions are there in the process?
Yeah. I think one of the biggest amounts of money that I've lost in a product or an early stage development was with my ex and her sister developing a coaching app. And all the coaches we spoke to said it was a big problem. And yes, this would be great. And yes, we would adopt it. When the push came to the shove, they liked doing things their own way. We, or I at least, assumed that if there was no app, if we just hit people up on LinkedIn, you don't have an app, you need an app, you'll just go and buy and download the app. But it just, So even then it's hard. People that tell you that it's a problem and they will engage with it, then you actually find behaviorally it's not as easy as you think.
Now, by the time you ask for credit card details, it's about 0.1% of those that were screaming how much they loved it and couldn't wait for it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was always the product just wasn't quite ready. Oh, we need this feature or we need that. And I still think it was a tremendous idea and opportunity. And yeah, there's intellectually should have been something great, but just couldn't get that early traction, couldn't get the buy-in, couldn't get the... I remember saying, right, we're going to do a competition of who can get the most downloads and the most customers. And in my mind, LinkedIn was the perfect way and had the scripts ready to go. But the customer apathy was just difficult and probably just throwing too much resources at the development rather than the adoption. And anyway, the many lessons out of that. And sometimes it's not the product, but sometimes actually you don't need more money for some of these things. You actually need a better value proposition, which could be a product or the problem that you're solving, like we've discussed. Now, the argument from the entrepreneur is, give me more money and I'll go and build a better product. But that's just not what people are accepting at the moment.
No, I remember seeing, this goes back a bit, but there were two startups came for funding once about the same time. One had spent, I think it was about 18 months in development in stealth, spent $1.5 million on the product, but yet to show it to a customer. And the other one had customers, but the most terrible, shitty product that was falling over, customers calling support because it was crashing. And straight off the bat, you know which one is more investable. It's much easier to fix a product problem than to go and get the customers and validate the market.
Yeah.
I'd rather have a shitty product and great customers that love it and keep using it regardless of how shitty it is than vice versa.
Yeah, 100%. And then one of the other reminders, and this one's a challenging one, but to me, successful entrepreneurship it's a balance between irrational exuberance and being batshit crazy with a never give it up attitude.
Wait, we have to balance those things?
I haven't got to the balance bit. The balance bit's on the other side where you've got to still have some ability to understand reality of the situation and deal with it. And it's such a fine line that success leaves clues and it's these irrational looks at the world, doesn't like the way the world is, creates this thing, breaks down barriers, doesn't give up, and there's 5 minutes to midnight when it works. But then on the other side, and we've heard from founders getting advice from advisors that are too much on the irrational side, just telling them, nah, if the investor doesn't like it, tell them to get stuffed. Yeah, okay. What do we do to balance the reality of if investors are looking for this, how do we balance that?
Or worse, I hear founders who say they're going to every type of customer and saying, the customer doesn't get it. And it's like, okay, at what point do you find the customer who does get it and how many of those are in the world?
It's a bit like in relationships, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? It's like in that as well. Okay, do you want to be right or do you want to be successful? Because if you think they don't get it and you want to teach them a lesson and stay with this thing, well, do you want to be right or successful? It's just a fine line.
Yeah. Yep.
But what we are seeing is in that search for organic growth, and we talked about it a bit on that last episode, the ability to be resourceful over resources and then just use tools to get a better leverage outcome. And Jack, you've been using Fathom just to take meeting notes on an automated basis and then convert them. Like that little tool has improved unbelievably to a point that it's adding actual value.
Yeah. So for listeners that haven't heard of Fathom, it's just an AI integration. Oh, it's an integration with Zoom that basically listens to the call and then writes and summarizes the notes. And we've been trialing it with pitch calls and it's bang on. It's better. Like it's a better job than we could do.
But what I find amazing is just the way it gets the headings right or has been getting the headings right. And then the end action items, who's taking accountability for what. And then it like where it can, it puts like when it's due. It really is good.
And for us, like we do back-to-back calls on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
It's like trying to engage in a call with a founder, but then also take notes at the same time. Like there's a balance there, but when you've got this integration behind the scenes, it's so helpful.
So helpful.
What I'm looking forward to is with our deal filtering tool is that when the AI can go and populate a lot of that, and then it's not to make the decision for us, but more and more in VC and investing, I think you've got to be able to, sure, bring some experience, but we actually need some systems to help us with our biases, and the biases filter out good stuff sometimes, and sometimes the biases filter in terrible stuff. And so when it can help us pattern match to at least give us a bit of a, hey, here's a watch out for this criteria you've got. There was either no information or some negative information around that. That's what I'm going to be looking forward to.
I'm waiting for the next evolution where while it's there listening, it actually starts correlating to past data and suggesting things during the call or flagging things that are inconsistent or prompting you with potential questions to ask to go deeper that are gaps in the analysis. Like, I can see where this becomes, we were talking about the second brain for data storage. This is like the second brain for actual critical thinking in real time.
My fear is that then it evaluates us and then goes not competent. And then to protect people, it like goes onto our network and
Fathom has left the meeting.
I can't fathom the lunacy of this. And then another one that was shown to me this week by Peter from Tally, and he's going to come on as a guest talking to us about recruitment and personality profiling, is HeyGen. And so what HeyGen does is allows you to create a really almost bang on avatar of yourself, your own recording, and then take scripts like a mail merge and then turn it around into personalized messages that if the person doesn't like know you as a friend, I watched this video of Peter and it looked like Peter talking. Like I wouldn't have picked it that it was an AI. His voice sounded a little bit more American than it actually is. But at scale, what you can now do is just with your CRM, hi, first name, and then based on where it is, give them the particular script based on the profile. And just at scale, you can be doing personalized video talking about stuff that actually matters to the person. Yeah, it's fascinating.
My call out here is there's a window of opportunity, and right now it's going to cut through all the noise, but as soon as that becomes adopted, like we're going to have to find another way, and it's going to go back to, is it personalized or does the message add value for someone to respond?
But can you imagine when you load into your avatar all of your previous message history? It knows all your personality profiles from all different types of psychological profiling tools, and it just becomes your avatar. And then to your point, Jack, this will end up, it'll be my AI talk to your AI. It's no longer my guys will talk to your guys, or my team will talk to your team.
Yeah.
We'll just let our AIs duel it out for us.
But you make a really important point, Jack. And so underlying all of this is having a culture, having a mindset, just accepts that nothing's forever and is really adaptable to change, finds the new thing, is at the front of the curve, like we discussed last week. And then when the thing ends up being a middle of the curve type issue, you're now in the stampede, get the hell out and start finding the new thing.
Yeah, agreed.
But look, those were just some reflections on deals taking a little bit longer. But what we're also seeing though is deals are still getting done and the valuations are starting to creep up. So in the Australian market, as an example, Procure Pro closed $6.15 million from Airtree and Sanyal Ventures. Procure Pro is a construction procurement platform that was founded in Brisbane in 2021. So quite new, and it has now 40 staff across Australia and New Zealand. And the capital is going to be used for accelerating growth into the UK as a key expansion market.
Yeah, it's interesting looking at the data you found there, Don, around the startup valuations rising. And it compared back to 21, like the boom time, and change in value since then, but also changes since Q1 23. And since Q1 23, everything's pretty much up except for Series C, which is still marginally down. But it's interesting to see at the seed stage since Q1 21, that's come like way back up, and starting to see still not as good in 23, like Q4 23 compared to Q1 21 for most rounds, like later stage rounds, but seed rounds definitely heading back up.
Yeah. And so seeing that data move, it just demonstrates if you've got a good business that can differentiate to customers, show a good go-to-market strategy, have investors believe that you can deploy that capital, the valuation's going up and the money is there.
Yeah, and it's interesting talking to different LPs, and we've mentioned this before, but they're not spoilt for choice right now.
No.
Like the returns that they can get on much less risky asset classes, it does beg the question, why would I be touching venture? And it was interesting chatting to some of the other VCs this week, and that reminder that that is a short-term view. Like there's value in diversification for investors, obviously, but also looking longer term. When you look at the event horizon of a typical VC return, the time that they return will be outside of these current returns that they're enjoying on these lower risk asset classes.
Yep, absolutely. An article that came out, I think a couple of weeks ago, was an entity that is a prolific deal doer, but I'm not sure gets the credit or spoken about in the marketplace, is Telstra Ventures.
Yeah, I've had a bit to do with Telstra Ventures on different Silicon Valley trade missions. They've always been generous hosts, and shout out to Mark Sherman, who's the managing partner in San Francisco for Telstra Ventures. But yeah, they've been quietly investing away, decent check sizes, good deal cadence, and it operates quite independently of Telstra. Like from what Mark shared with me previously, they have the autonomy to go and do their own thing, which as we know, six months ago, we were sharing the news that most CVC funds in Australia were being shut down, corporates were getting out of venture, but Telstra has just stuck with it consistently.
What they've seemed to have done is found their differentiator and their niche by being able to take their investments and then leverage Telstra's network of customers and relationships and partners to generate revenue for those startups.
Yeah, so I know they had a focus there for a while on health startups that they were plugging into the Telstra health package, which had quite a big customer segment in nursing homes and aged care facilities. So it's a smart play, given the customer database that Telstra has, when they invest to then be able to plug them into that network. It's a smart move by Telstra.
Yeah, so we'll see how they continue to go. We'd love to get Mark on the potty at some time.
Yeah, I'll make that happen. And no doubt we'll see Mark when we're in the US in October.
Now, I know I said I didn't want to ever talk about Tesla again, but you guys said we have to.
I did not recall those words ever leaving your mouth.
And there is a reasonable segue in that Telstra Ventures has Telstra in the name. Telstra's CFO once was Robin Denholm. So there is a reasonable segue?
I love the longbow segue that Don always manages to come up with.
Yeah, but I think Tesla dropped 12% last week on one day after its earnings, and people are learning that this may actually be a low-growth car company in a shitty business with an entrepreneur that sometimes is a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of actuals versus delivered.
I've been meaning to dig out a chart I saw of Tesla sales versus BYD and all the business metrics that underlie it compared to their share price.
I thought
just how outpriced Tesla is compared to a company that's
an AI company, better. Aaron.
That's a good chart. We should find that and link that, because that's a really good chart.
All right. Don will no doubt want to talk about Tesla next week as well. So let's find the chart.
Have you seen this chart?
I'm embarrassed to say that I haven't.
You'll have a laugh when you see it.
Let's do it now. What am I searching?
Okay, search Tesla versus BYD.
Tesla versus BYD metrics.
And just the difference in market cap for the metrics, it's crazy. Yeah.
See, I don't know what I'm...
I'll see if I can find it.
At some point, some companies need to have a bit of a reckoning. And when you look at the chart that I found, was production to inventory keeps rising in China, but production is flat. And so if they keep producing in an rising inventory basis, the only way you can clear that inventory is through discounts. And if you have a look at a lot of the prices for used Teslas, it is falling through the floor.
So many people on YouTube, like Tesla owners, ranting about the drop in value of their car, because you could basically buy 30 grand cheaper Tesla new than what they paid just months prior.
Yeah. I think it was 3 or 4 months ago that I said, hold me accountable. I've gone short again. When you look at the different patterns of behavior that are occurring, in my view, where this is headed is inevitable, but that it goes against the grain. But I see that Robin Denholm is just listed another automated sale plan for another 80 million. So that's the benefit of that is money coming into the Australian venture scene. Guess don't really have to make comment too much on anything else. But if people want to know how someone like Elon gets away with certain things, just pay people around you incredibly well. I think she sold 134 million worth of stock, then 170 million, then 85 million, and then another 80 million is coming out this year. So it is profitable to hang around with Elon.
Yeah, far out. They're decent chunks of cash to be taking off the table.
Bloody oath. All right.
For being a chair.
I was listening to someone who, remember when Trump launched his alternative to Twitter? And apparently it was priced at something like $10 a share when it went live. And this guy put he sold everything he owned and backed it because he thought, if Trump's behind this, even though I don't like him, it's going to return. It jumped up to 120 something a share when he sold out.
Wow.
So it's just phenomenal. Goes to show you might not like the person leading it, but geez, when they've got a bit of a cult following, the market does crazy things.
When they're hot, people often comment on like how are certain things allowed to happen. Actually really basic, right? It's show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. Why would you try and put guardrails around someone that delivers you that sort of personal wealth? Like, just let it ride. So that makes sense. But I just, at some point, the narrative changes. My prediction is Elon is setting things up so he can get ousted from Tesla.
It's a bold prediction.
It's just a pattern that you see when the entrepreneur knows what's happening. When you have a look at what's happening with Tesla as an auto, and even with Tesla against some of the other AI and robotics companies, a day of reckoning with balance sheets and the way it accounts and its revenues, those things often bubble up. And entrepreneurs love to have a bit of a sob story if you're at that end of the narcissism scale of, oh, it was everyone else. I tried, I was reasonable, and then this happened, and then they exit. And so my view here of what he's doing is to ask for something so outrageous that can't possibly be done, but all of his supporters support it. When you have a look at the sheer volume of people on social media saying, yeah, he's this generation's genius, give him what he wants, we need Elon to stay. I just don't understand how a board would be able to pull off what he wants. And I think that he knows that. And so my gut feel is that he's setting up a situation. He exits, he gets to have a reasonable reason to then clear out all the margin debt, sell out big chunks of shares, take that to go off and do other bits and pieces where he's SpaceX could well be a bigger thing when you actually have a look at what's occurring there.
Mm-hmm. No, look, it makes sense that the recurring pattern of behavior for narcissists is to destroy relationships to the point that they no longer have the relationship. And it's like a pattern that's evolved from their childhood around the age of four. And so you see it play out with Musk, even with things like the Twitter deal, pulling out of the Twitter deal, then in Twitter, then his whole hoo-ha about if anyone doesn't like advertising on my platform because of what I say, then F off then. Like it is, I don't know if it's conscious that he's doing it, but absolutely there's a pattern of behavior there.
Yeah. If you're just concentrating on returns, do you want to be right or do you want to be rich? So just back the rocket. I don't know.
Jeez, we sound like a cynical bunch. Do you want to be right or happy, right or rich? We're implying these things are all mutually exclusive.
We've discussed it before. There's what is in the world. It's what we want and what we think should be, and anchor too much towards what should be. Life's hard. Life's hard enough as it is, but when you accept what is and just get on with it, I don't know. That's my chosen path.
The root of unhappiness is unrealized expectations, right?
No, that is true. That is true. When expectations outstrip what is, the gap leaves a bit of a problem. Actually, one of the reasons why I don't like Microsoft Teams, I had to use it yesterday. I don't know where the setting is on this, but this setting on what we use to record and even Zoom, I think it does something and it makes you look a little less old and shit. Microsoft Teams doesn't have that. And every time I log into Teams and if it's too early in the morning and it gives me like a blast of what I actually look like versus a little bit of touching up, it's very aggressive.
So I've been meaning to say this to you, Don. I totally forgot because we're usually on a call with others. But there's some device that you log in on Zoom via that completely adjusts like the touch up to the point that you almost look like a comic character.
Which device?
I don't know. But it touches you up so well. It just looks like a comical drawing.
It's like one of those AI avatars. Good feedback. What's that song? You're So Vain.
It's only taken me 2 years to give you the feedback.
So anyway, that's my prediction. Elon setting himself out. All right. So for those listening at home, this bit is actually recorded separately because while we were recording, it was announced that a Delaware judge has struck down the pay packet awarded 5 years ago after it was decided that it was, let's get the right words here, excessive. The decision on Tuesday means that more than 5 years after the electric car maker's co-founder was granted the largest executive compensation plan in history, Tesla's board will have to start over and come up with a new proposal. The ruling leaves Mr. Musk and his fortune in limbo. The pay packet was essentially $51.1 billion, and without them, his net worth drops by 25%. So this is interesting. The courts are here to put guardrails around people.
Apparently this is one shareholder instigated this.
Yeah.
And no wonder, like a $50 billion payday back in 2018.
US, that is.
Yeah, that's US.
Now, some people will say at the time the share price was low and he had to grow it by a certain amount. But what the judgment, let me just find it here. Put simply, neither the compensation committee nor the board acted in the best interest of the company when negotiating Musk's compensation plan. In fact, there is barely any evidence of negotiations at all. Rather than negotiate against Musk with the mindset of a third party, the compensation committee worked alongside him almost as an advisory body. Ultimately, all of the directors act under a controlled mindset, calling into question the disclosure as to each of them. If we, like we discussed before, if you're the chairman and you make hundreds of millions of dollars as a chair, of course you're just going to, like, you can't say no to that. Money buys everyone.
I saw Musk made a, I think it was a tweet, but he said the insight he took from this is don't set up in Delaware because companies should be allowed to be run by the decisions of their shareholders. The irony of that is this was a shareholder that launched this action, yeah, and it clearly, based on the judgment and the comments, wasn't actually in the best interest of shareholders.
See, the thing for me is a lot of people find some of my Tesla stuff as lunacy, but I've actually read the depositions and the rulings of things like the Solar City debacle, the SEC stuff. And when you get in there, this is a board that objectively fails constantly. Now, what the judge said of Robin Denholm is, moreover, Denholm's approach to enforcement of things like the SEC settlement, including unawareness of its key requirements, suggests a lackadaisical approach to her oversight obligations. Ouch.
Yeah, that's a pretty clear statement.
Yeah. So I think it's just important that we add that in because that's some clear news. Because if you think through the consequences of this, it's people talk about wealth in the concept of shares, but shares need to liquidate it. And the way they get around these things is through margin loans and debt facilities. If you've had a big chunk of your shares taken, that's going to create some interesting outcomes. I wonder how this affects the Twitter financing and what deals with the devil he would have done behind the scenes to pull off $44 billion, having only sold whatever billion dollars. So I wonder if, again, coming back to my early theory that he's trying to set up to get pushed out of Tesla. So then that way, when inevitably, as things always happen, when shit hits the fan, oh, it wasn't me. It was fine when I was there.
Yeah, this is a moment he could leverage to 5 years later to have that sort of money, capital, value pulled from you. You could use that as an excuse to unravel all sorts of stuff.
Now, in the aftermarket, it is only down about 2.5%. So yeah, the market doesn't. So I'm just trying to think through the market. So if it was struck down and they had to come back with a different pay packet, which is less, it means less dilution for the other shareholders. So that is probably positive if you're an equity holder, negative if it's the kind of thing, if you believe Elon Musk is the savior to all humanity and this potentially risks losing him. This could be negative, so it'll be interesting to see how the market.
Have they already factored in Musk and his personality? And therefore, these are not surprises.
It goes on and says, how do Denholm and the rest of the board, which includes James Murdoch, who McCormick said lacks independence due to personal connection with Musk, approach the CEO's new push for more voting power in light of the judgment that makes clear Musk already wields incredible power over Faye Denholm's tightrope walking between harnessing Musk's brilliance and reigning in his excesses was hard enough. It just got harder.
I do feel for people like you, Don, sitting on these put options and shorting Tesla and seeing it defy gravity in moments that should otherwise, or for any other company, would be an absolute demise. But
let's just separate. Let's make sure that we separate things into component parts. There's Elon, there's Tesla. Tesla as a vehicle has done wonderful things for the industry. Tesla as a user experience is incredibly good. If I drive around in other people's Teslas, it's a great car. But the equity layer of the capital stack, I have some doubts of. And Aaron, you shared that chart that we were talking about. Let's just for fun bring that up here. Let me open up computer to load. Because I edit this, I then have to re-listen to myself. And whenever this topic comes up, I do appreciate to the listeners at home, I accept my voice changes, my demeanor changes. Unhinged is not too strong a word. So I'm not deaf to it.
I just thought of a new award for the next Tribe Christmas party.
What? Most unhinged?
Most unhinged, yeah. It warrants a T-shirt.
And this is, yeah, it's do you want to be rich or do you want to be happy? So, Aaron, you had found this.
Yeah, so I've seen a few versions of this one, but just for the comparison.
In terms of global sales, was 90,891 last quarter, down 5%. BYD, whilst it was down, it's now at 97,000 units in that quarter, so it's up. Percentage of them that are an SUV, Tesla's 14%, BYD's 56%. Percentage of new energy vehicle, 100% to Tesla, whereas BYD do a combination, so they're at 40%. Revenue was down 4% for Tesla, whereas up 30% for BYD. So Tesla's 5.3 billion, BYD 4.8 billion. Operating income, who needs income and profits? That's so dumb to even have a chart. Is 292, that's down 147, and that includes a whole lot of interesting things if you get into the balance sheet.
Yeah.
Whereas BYD is more than twice that at 600. Operating margin, 5.4% for Tesla, BYD 13.6, and the operating margin per unit sold is 3,205, whereas BYD is 6,708, and Tesla beats them for cash, 7.6 billion and then only 1.6 billion. But if you're producing income growing at that rate, it won't be long until you've got that amount of cash on there.
What this one's missing, Don, is the market cap, which I saw, and like the market cap of Tesla just ridiculously outweighs BYD. Okay, so
all of those fans that then say, yeah, but you don't understand, it's robotics, it's self-driving, it's AI. Okay, let's see. All the stats that I see is that self-driving, that other companies are well ahead of, robotics, that thing of the robot folding a shirt, later it comes out, it's like still tethered and it's just doing a repeatable thing. It was pre-programmed. Yeah. Wasn't autonomous at all.
Yeah. And yeah, comparison of product versus comparison of commercials.
And if the lunatic does fuck off and then goes and does robotics and all that other stuff elsewhere and leaves the self-driving cars to smash into other cars or tractors or walls, good luck. So shall we leave the Don's heart rate elevates, he gets a bit unhinged and go back to normal programming?
I think we should.
Now, speaking of people that seem to be difficult to work for, and whilst mining is not tech, it's hard not to continue to read some of the stories coming out of Fortescue Metals with Twiggy. Like, that guy can't keep staff to save his life.
Yeah.
The new chief financial officer has exited the company after less than 5 months. I think one of them was 2 months. The one prior to that was 7 months. This is the third prominent departure in the last 7 days after the exit of the former Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, and then the external affairs boss. Now, the ratings agency Moody's said that the Fortescue's high churn was negative for its credit rating, but investors are not deterred because shares hit a record high.
Yes. Usually, like we talk about, these things are a sign of other underlying issues that inevitably come out. But while share price is growing and whatever investors are seeing in returns and other things, it can be masking the internal conflict.
The reason why I think it's relevant for a tech VC podcast is there's a couple of things. From an investment point of view, I like things where the customer doesn't care about what's happening internally, especially at executive ranks, right? So clearly shareholders and customers buying iron ore and the iron ore cash flows, they couldn't give a shit about this. Because I was in one of the businesses that it was like a high trust, low customer volume. Everybody knew each other. Everybody knew what was happening. And customers did care about the little things that's happening. And that did affect your revenue. And so one of the things I'm always having a look at in terms of growth and scaling a business, because it's always messy. There's always stuff happening internally. It's always a complex issue of he said, she said. So I like things whereas the customer's always just going to look at the product and no one really gives a shit about that. And my previous life was insurance. And once someone left a company, they took all of their relationships with them and that revenue went with them. That was difficult. So that's a pattern that I see as a lesson here, that Twiggy can do whatever he's doing to people and people can leave and crack the shits, but record high, customers love it.
Yep. Yeah, so true. It is a great sign of demand, right?
And really what the issue is internally with high turnover companies is what we've talked about before, is integration versus disintegration. And this is a concept taught to me by Ishak Adesis, but in a fixed energy world, there's only 100%. There's no 150%. There's no more than 24 hours a day. And energy gets predictably allocated. It first goes to friction. It first goes to problems. And in cultures, it first goes to disintegration. When people are fighting, when people are not aligned, when all these issues are happening, that's where your energy gets consumed. And so in a fixed energy world of 100%, if half your energy is going into infighting and people coming and going and factions, by definition, only 50% of your energy can go out to solve problems and capitalize on customers. And so what happens is investors might not care about it now, but the check for this comes later. Because if you've got a culture that's internally disintegrated, even if it's got record profits now, there are things not being dealt with. There are opportunities not being capitalized on. There are problems just brewing because of this disintegration, this energy going elsewhere. That is a real problem. And so for me, when we're analyzing a culture to invest in, and then with the post-investment support that we're trying to do, is how do we keep them integrated? How do we get all that energy aligned? How do we keep them moving and traversing the normal conflicts that occur, rather than a revolving door of people, because that kills companies?
Yeah, I'm always reminded of the plane crash investigation of commercial aircraft and how they forget to actually fly the plane because they're dealing with some sort of conflict or some sort of issue that becomes distraction, that takes all their energy, and a perfectly functioning aircraft ends up in the ground. And yeah, I had a really long chat this week with a founder who's dealing with a co-founder relationship breakup, and just reminding them that this will kill the business if it becomes the sum total of your focus, and you need to compartmentalize it and make sure it occupies no more than 10% of your day, which is some great advice I received in the past. So that ability
even
to-
Even then, that phone call they made to you wasn't about sales or a customer or a new development. It's how do I deal? It's just energy that disappears.
Yeah. And the broken sleep, the background thought, the subconscious thinking, the emotional turmoil that is then draining, that takes you off your peak mindset and performance. So it becomes all consuming unless you have really good practices to manage that emotionally and personally, but then also as a team, the ability to manage and navigate conflict together is a critical skill. And so this will play out over time. It'll be interesting to see what happens in this particular case with more time.
If you have a look at any great company that disappeared, internally what starts to brew is conflict of perception, conflict of interest. It just starts to bring things down, and people blame technology or people blame competitors. No, actually, you started to get disintegrated. You didn't get on top of that disintegration. You couldn't solve problems. You couldn't capitalize on opportunities, and you disappear. Mm-hmm. Segueing back, Twiggy just doesn't pay his people enough. Elon wraps them in cash and creates the ability for them to put up with all sorts of stuff, like the lawsuits and the everything. Twiggy, give him better options packages, mate, and you can get away with whatever you want whenever you want. The other little reminder is, and I think the lesson, people don't leave companies. People leave people. Mm. Now, you're either leaving because of your manager or your leader, or you're leaving because of the team dynamics or the culture. But whenever somebody leaves and there's an excuse given, there's always quite rational, isn't there? Whatever, they just wanted a change, or either your culture didn't support them in their growth, or you as a leader, or whatever it might be. And the self-reflection there is really important, because that is the reality. And so the article talks about, one of them left to take up a new opportunity here. So either they didn't like the culture, they didn't like Twiggy, they didn't like something, but it's people, why people leave.
People. And this is why most M&A activity fails, right? You look at a startup company that gets acquired, the founder comes into this organization, they now have managers and others they're responsible for. It's not the natural environment for an E-style energy. So the entrepreneur typically leaves as soon as their earnout period is done, or even sometimes before. And then what happens? Most of the team that came over ends up leaving. And I think there's too much value. I think most acquisitions are misunderstood. Like they actually don't understand that the entrepreneur leading it, that energy, that drive, that people are staying and following that person almost like some sort of cult in many cases, and it's family. And as soon as that gets fractured, that the value's lost.
Yeah.
And there's a mass departure.
That's why I still think Simon from
Culture Kings
will end up buying back Culture Kings for penny on the dollar.
I really hope that happens.
Yeah, that'd be awesome to see. Yeah. He's got the energy. He's ready to do it.
Yeah. Whereas Jack, we've got dirt on Jack and we've threatened to kill him. So
you're gonna say, yeah, if it's here for culture, I don't know. It can't be money either, so fuck knows.
Just more swag. More swag. Yeah.
Here for the moon.
Good, Jack. We're leaders in different aspects of our life. And whether that's with family or business, and for me, I wear multiple hats. Recently, there's been some things where I've just either been really distracted or just not present to the fact that if I'm not careful here, my communication, my engagement is going to drive these people out because I'm not delivering what they need. And when you're wearing multiple hats, it's just incredibly important to always be coming back present and have an environment of good feedback and foster some emotional maturity where people can have those conversations early. It's like the great T. Swift says, "Hi, it's me. I'm the problem. It's me." Always accept that. And then there was just a post that came up. Richard Branson has 19 million followers, whereas Virgin has 270,000. Gates has 35 million followers, but Microsoft only has 21. Gary Vaynerchuk has 5.5 million followers, but his company only has 95,000 followers. Blah, blah, blah. People follow people.
Yeah.
People aren't following brands. And we see this in our LinkedIn. We do the company LinkedIn posts just to make it sure that if people stumble on our LinkedIn profile as a company, that we look like we're alive. But we get 100 times more engagement when we do stuff personally than we do from the company.
And the more personal the content is, the more engagement we get.
Yeah, and it's random on the way the algorithm works.
Yeah, a perfect example is Peter Walker from Carter. Like, he posts all of the data from his personal page, and like, we speak about his data points regularly on this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now that flows back to Carter. Like, we know where that data is coming from, but there's a few in our portfolio that I've suggested. It's like, you keep posting this stuff from the company page, but when I go to your personal brand, it's every month. Once a month, there's some random thing. It should be the other way. Every day there needs to be something, because people ultimately buy from humans. People follow humans. People want to build trust in humans. And then the brand, like, it's almost like that then becomes a threshold thing of, is there professionality here? Mm. Can they stand behind it? Are all the ingredients that I need in place for me to support this company? But in the place that we play, we're all about early stage, and therefore it's often about the individual.
Yeah, I also think consumer sentiment has changed a lot with social media, where people want to know the people behind the company they're buying from. It's not just faceless organizations, particularly in VC, like particularly the world we play in. This is about relationships.
And that's why, coming back to last week's episode about having authentic content, the need to have content in-house. And even this week, someone Jack knows had created a video. They just stayed at an Airbnb, created a video, and that video's now got, I think it was 32,000 comments. It wasn't too much to it. It was just someone enjoying an Airbnb, and the Airbnb was pretty cool. He put it out there, and now he's a content king, being sent around to different Airbnbs to create them cool videos.
A bad gig.
God, it's a good gig.
Short form content that's just real.
Yeah, real and authentic.
Yeah.
Anything else we'd like to discuss today, lads?
Oh, that's probably enough for people, I think. Congratulations if you're still listening to the podcast.
Congratulations or commiserations?
Both.
Yeah. All right. We've got some great founder and investor focus podcasts in the can. They're going to start coming out the next couple of weeks. Looking forward to getting those out. And we've got a big day today. We've got a couple of deals in the late stage that we're looking at before going to IC. So I'm really excited by today.
Yeah. Back-to-back calls today. And then we're catching up with a group of investors in Brizzy afternoon as well, which will be good.
Yeah. And then we're end of January now. Things are starting to heat up. People are starting to get back.
Already the year is flying.
Aaron, I'll see you this afternoon. Jack, I'll see you online, but looking forward to getting down to Radelaide.
Sounds good. Yeah, we've got a few calls together today.
See you on the other side.
See you guys.
See you then.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you're a sophisticated investor under Australian law, we'd welcome you to sign up to our investor syndicate, where we'll notify you of investment opportunities as they come up. If you're a B2B founder and think Tribe would be a fit for you, go to Get Capital page of our website. And whether you're a founder or an investor, if you're looking to take your early stage investing or company to the next level in 2024, consider joining one of our offsites or US and UK market entry missions occurring in February, March, May, June, August, and November.